Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Three guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Joel Shalit on Israel's identity crisis. Then, about a quarter past the hour, we'll hear from Michael Heaney on how Obama demobilized the anti-war movement. And then at the bottom of the hour, Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street, just out in paper, will talk about the financial crisis and its consequences. With all the debt ceiling and government closure melodrama, I want to take a longer look at fiscal policy and politics next week, but I'll just say this. It's amazing how a consensus around austerity has developed. There is virtually no one with any influence in public life talking about the need to help the unemployed or generate long-term, earth-friendly growth. It's all about how much to cut and where. No one will dare say tax the rich and rebuild America, even though that polls surprisingly well. And a note in the politics. Yes, the Republicans are savage in their lust to cut spending and keep taxes low on the plutocrats, but that only serves to legitimate Obama's own austerity schemes. My guess is that he's happy to have machete-bearing lunatics to which he can appear like the reasonable alternative, and that leaves no one to make the argument for humane stimulative policies. Okay, Joel Shalit. Joel is an Israeli-American scholar and journalist whose most recent book is Israel vs. Utopia from Akashic Books. He's co-editor of a new webzine named Souciant.com, S-O-U-C-I-A-N-T, French for caring, the opposite of insouciant. He's got a piece in the site about how Israel sees itself as hopelessly misunderstood. Joel Shalit. Apologies for the sound quality, but he only had a cell phone. All right, now let's talk about this piece you did for Souciant, Actually Existing Israel. You had a commenter who got you thinking. Tell us about your commenter.
Yeah, that commenter was very interesting. As I explain in the article, if you work in Jewish periodical publishing or you are somehow put in an editorial context where you have to run a lot of Mideast news coverage, it's inevitable that you're going to be subject to a lot of commenting abuse and abuse in the talkback. And you have to heavily manage commenting on Mideast and Israel-focused articles, specifically also to protect your writers, because the level of negativity that your articles and your journalists can be subject to can be practically debilitating for a lot of correspondents, no matter how seasoned they are at covering the Middle East or writing about Israel. This was a particularly interesting commenter, because instead of just being, a verbally violent jerk towards the journalist he was criticizing, an Israeli woman journalist writing about an anti-war demonstration during Operation Cast Lead in Tel Aviv that I believe was led by Hadash, what was once called Israel's Communist Party, the commenter made some very strange philosophical digressions that were extremely revelatory about the way that right-wingers like to think about Israel's place in the world and where it sits in a continuum between the West or the Occident and the Middle East. He wanted to very much convince folks following the comments and readers of the article that Israel can't be judged by Western standards of morality because it is not a Western country. And the implication of his argument was also that Israel is not a Middle Eastern country either. It is its own civilizational continuum. And for anybody with any understanding of the history of right-wing religious thinking about Israel and more recent right-wing political thinking about Israel's civilizational character, that's all very heavy stuff.
But there's also this line that you have to be there to understand it. If you're not there, you really can't understand, and you have no standing to comment. He was sitting in Brooklyn as he wrote this, and he was redacting to an Israeli writing about Israeli politics. But where did you get this from? Is this a talking point that is distributed by the lobby?
Certain conservative groups, as well as organizations that are, I think, reasonably affiliated with the Israeli government, or some would argue the Israeli security services, are given instructions to provide counter-propaganda online and populate talkbacks to offer opposing opinions when there is a concern that too much of the media is anti-Israeli and that Israel is not getting, you know, a fair shot in the media, that Israel is being criticized for racist reasons and reasons of bias that unfairly compromise the Israeli state. And this guy was a fairly sophisticated version of the kind of person who is recruited to do that kind of work. And one of the typical postures that you encounter in Jewish periodical publishing in particular are Americans and European Jews going in drag as Israelis, trying to offer the authentic Israeli point of view, which they can never properly offer themselves because they are not Israelis. But, you know, you would never know that they weren't Israeli online. If they say they're Israeli, you'd think they're Israeli. But I have time and time again gone in and done research on commenters who allege that they are Israelis or that they are writing from Israel, and, you know, two-thirds of the time they tend to be Americans. So whoever is issuing them instructions to represent an Israeli point of view as Israeli, Israel tends to be more of an ideological posture than an Israeli identity tends to represent a particular kind of political posture than it is an actual national identity for these kinds of commenters on articles about Israel. It's own, you know, cultural world. It's fascinating. And somebody should sit down with a bunch of these people who actually do this sort of work, who'd be willing to talk about it, and ask them to explain what it is about Israeli national identity that makes them want to perform it online, even though they're not Israelis themselves. Quite often you'll find that a lot of these people aren't Jews either, which is even more baffling, but it has to do, you know, points to the fact that there is a kind of political character implied by Israeli conservatism and Israeli foreign policy that right-wingers in the West really gravitate towards, that what they perceive to be the Israeli political character activates some kind of mimetic, typically fascist desire to take over Jewish identity in the form of Israel. And if they can perform it somehow online, they've gotten half the way there. And I think it's very dangerous to court this in trying to rally Western support for Israeli policy for that reason alone. As far as the local argument that you were asking about in the article, the local theme is very important in Israel. As I explain in the article, for decades it has been argued in Zionist circles that you can't really understand what Israel does, what Israel's circumstances are, unless you are there on the ground experiencing the uniqueness of Israeli life for what it is. And only at that point will you get why it is the Israeli government has to do the kinds of things it does in order to protect the Jewish state. And this has been, over time, transformed into a typically a reactionary form of reasoning used to justify why Israel shouldn't politically conform with what's called Western moral standards.
Now, one question is whether the West conforms to those standards, right?
Right, of course. But it is a way of essential critiquing theories of universal morality that are common amongst liberals in the West.
Now, I want to return to the question of Israeli national identity in a moment, but the controversy that this commenter was remarking on was about Israel's action against Gaza at the end of 2008-2009, which was called Operation Cast Lead, which was just a one-sided, it's wrong to call it a war, it's just a one-sided pummeling. I guess the argument is we can't really understand why Israel had to do this for a couple of weeks to Gaza if we're not there. Is that the line of thinking?
He was making that argument specifically and also universally, because he wanted to make it clear that Westerners are not in the position of being able to judge Israeli policy towards the Palestinians under any context.
I'm speaking with Joel Shalit, author most recently of Israel versus Utopia, and also editor of the online magazine Souciant.com. Let's talk a bit about Israel national identity, which you say is becoming increasingly just being the other of the Palestinians. When we spoke several years ago, you said that Israel is so fractured internally that it's only its sense of permanent war that gives it any coherence and identity. So is this really what constitutes Israel's national identity now?
Israel is a country that is radically misunderstood abroad. I will insist that this is very much true, if only because ideologically it's a very complex society with many competing economic and cultural interests, which has been for a number of decades now, almost three, undergoing a remarkable neoliberal transformation. And the present government is probably the most, led by Benjamin Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman, is probably the most conservative government the country has had in decades, if ever. It's the most explicitly reactionary government that has run the country in my lifetime. I thought when I was in high school that Menachem Begin was the worst thing that had ever hit the country, but Bibi's second term in office makes all the previous right-wing governments look communist by comparison. So what's happening to Israeli political identity right now is it is becoming radicalized by a combination of the leadership of the Netanyahu government, its policies, and the impact of, in particular, the last 10 years of conflict with the Palestinians and the Lebanese. You know, it's often not fully appreciated the degree to which Israel's disastrous performance in the 2006 Lebanon War has put a certain kind of dramatic fear into Israelis that would make them, for example, be more prejudiced towards Arabs than they were before the conflict. Up to 300,000 Israelis had to evacuate their homes due to missiles falling, you know, on their neighborhoods in the north. You know, that's a big deal. And that the way that traumatic events like that in Israel get fun for the civilian population by the government is generally in a very reactionary direction. Israelis aren't encouraged to think that 300,000 Israelis had to flee their homes because of poor government policy. They're encouraged to think that this happened because the Arabs are anti-Semites. There is an unbelievable amount of very, very, very negative groupthink in Israel that's promoted by the government, that's promoted by the media, that constitutes its own version of programming. I've said in my books, I've talked about the need to deprogram Israeli society in a kind of a soft way. But I think that as a formerly socialist country with a lot of immigrants from the former Soviet Union, there is in the mainstream political culture a tendency towards a kind of collectivism, of a very negative collectivism, that makes it very difficult for people to think for themselves because the state and its propagandistic tendencies are so overwhelming. A Palestinian I know once remarked, "Israel is the world's biggest marketing campaign." There's some truth to that. His comment was in reference to the fact that, you know, whenever there's criticism of Israel abroad, there's an emissary of the state in the form of an Israeli or a foreign Jew to repudiate that position. But in fact, the kind of messaging that you get, the kind of what they call hasbara, the propaganda or Israel education that you get abroad, coming from the Israeli government or deputies abroad, is also very strongly directed at Israelis themselves. And Israelis are constantly being worked over by the government to agree with its policies and to assume that whatever the government thinks is in their is best for them is actually in their interest.
Now, you say at the end of the piece that it's wrong to construct this as a swing to the right because that implies there will be some kind of swing to the left sometime soon. This is really a direction that Israeli society is evolving in, and there's no obvious way back.
Yes. Noam Shezaf and Haaretz, who works for Haaretz, wrote an interesting piece for his magazine 972mag.com. It's a new Israeli online, left-wing online publication. That it's a daily web magazine and a blog aggregator of left Israeli blogs that I highly recommend for anybody who's interested in the Israeli left to read. He recently made the argument that Israel has always been a very conservative place. It's never really had a left, and it's and I think that there's some truth to that. So when I make that statement in the article, it's partially a reflection of my agreeing with that kind of position, that there is a fundamental conservatism that lies at the core of Israeli politics that means that you can't necessarily expect the kind of pendulum swings that are typical of liberal democracies in the West. And as I argue in Israel versus Utopia, part of what makes deciphering Israeli politics so difficult is that Israeli politics will, on the one hand, evince elements of historical materialism, and on the other hand, apocalyptic religious messianism at the exact same time. And so the standards that we're used to appealing to distinguish between right and left in the United States and Europe do not hold in an Israeli context. They just don't. And some analysts of Israeli politics who are, for example, scholars of authoritarianism and totalitarianism in Europe would say, well, of course, this is typical of societies that mix the red with the brown. This is typical of societies that are, you know, innately fascist in their outlook. I'm not sure we can reduce things that easily either, but because Zionism is a nationalism that was born at the same time as the worst kinds of European nationalisms that we're familiar with from the late 19th and through the mid-20th century, it will always be in dialogue with 20th century fascism, and it will bear similarities to it, that Israel is undergoing a crisis in terms of its own democratic political structures and institutions right now, as so many Israelis are arguing, doesn't help with deflecting the criticism that Israeli society is turning fascist because it's always been fascist.
That was Joel Shalit. His most recent book is Israel versus Utopia from Akashic. He's co-editor of a new webzine named Souciant.com, Souciant. Back to talk demobilization after a musical break. Continuing last week's indie rock revival, that was Built to Spill, doing some of Temporarily Blind. My next guest is Michael Heaney, professor of political science at the University of Michigan. He and Fabio Rojas of Indiana University have been studying the anti-war movement for the last 8 years or so, and they've got a paper in the journal Mobilization on where it went. In a phrase, Obama killed it. Michael Heaney. Some people have given reasons for the decline of the anti-war movement include fatigue, a sense of the impotence of protest, or maybe just the disappearance of the war. The war is plural, really, in media and politics, but you've got different reasons. What have you found? Why did the anti-war movement dwindle into near nothingness, even though these wars have gone on and on and on?
Well, Doug, let me just start by saying that all of the reasons that you've mentioned for the decline of the movement are likely very important reasons for its decline. One of the frustrations of activists was carrying out protests for years and not seeing a concrete adjustment in policy. So there's no doubt that belief in the impotence of protest and the decline of the wars and also just general fatigue are likely reasons for the decline of the anti-war movement. But at the same time, my colleague Fabio Rojas and I have been conducting research over the past 5 years that suggests that there may be other reasons for the decline that are linked more to the success of the Democratic Party. specifically the rise of Barack Obama as president, and his role of having been an anti-war protester and a voice against the anti-war movement during his candidacy. Our research surveyed anti-war demonstrators from 2004 through 2010. And in a recent article, we report the results that we found from 2007 to 2009, which was a period of substantial decline in the movement.
Let's go back and talk about your earlier research. I didn't read that paper, but what did you find in the early days when the anti-war movement was really cooking?
Well, in the research that we did between 2004 and 2005, we found that ties to the Democratic Party were a very important part of the rise of the anti-war movement, that people who were connected to the Democratic Party found the anti-war movement to be an important reason for them to turn out to protest, and that anti-war protests were both a way that they could both advance the cause of the Democratic Party and advance the anti-war movement together. We call that group of people who sort of have this dual allegiance between the Democrats and the anti-war movement, we call that the party in the street. And our research shows that in the early years of the movement, from especially in this 2004 to 2005 period, that this party in the street was really critical to the mobilization of the anti-war movement.
Then, of course, the war went on, and then there became a new president. So what happened when the partisan cast of the White House changed?
It was more than just the new president, but it was the rise of Democratic electoral success that hurt the anti-war movement. Beginning in the 2006 midterm elections, the Democrats captured control of Congress. Also in 2008, even before the Democrats won the White House, once it became clear that Barack Obama would be the nominee of the Democratic Party, the anti-war movement could see that there was a voice for peace that was arising within the Democratic Party. And then the nail in the coffin of the movement, in a sense, was the actual election and inauguration of Barack Obama as president. So once that happened, in a sense, the mission of the anti-war movement, the mission of the peace movement had been fulfilled. But there was also a sense that even if Barack Obama did not fully carry out the mission of peace, that the threat to peace that was represented by George W. Bush had abated. And since people mobilize more fervently in response to threats than they do in response to opportunities, the disappearance of this threat meant the disappearance of the motivation of people to engage in activism.
But if you go back in time, though, having a Democrat prosecuting the Vietnam War didn't demobilize the anti-war movement. That went on and on.
Well, that's an excellent point. And it's also important to note that that was a very different time in terms of the relationship between the party system and the American people. During the 1960s, the party system really was not polarized in the way that it is today. We were actually at a period in our history that was relatively low in terms of polarization. Whereas today, the two parties are divided in a way that they haven't been in a very long time. And so there's a much closer association today between people's attitudes on any given political issue and which party they're a member of. So because of that, there's the kind of connection today that there wasn't during the 1960s.
Now, this notion of increasing polarization of the parties is, I know it's a commonplace in the political science literature, but an awful lot of people, particularly activists on the left, think quite the opposite, that the parties are more alike than ever and that the Democratic Party is just as enthralled to Wall Street and imperial war as the Republican Party is. How do you reconcile these opposing perceptions?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think that I certainly understand how from the point of view of activists who are on the left of the Democratic Party, how it very much seems like on the point of war that the two parties seem to be very similar to one another. However, when you look at what the parties do, you see that there really is quite a substantial difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Especially during the 2001 to 2008 period, I would summarize that difference as follows. The Republican Party more or less stood cohesively in favor of military action in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the Democratic Party was very much split. So there's a very substantial faction within the Democratic Party, within the Democratic caucus in the Congress. It has historically been about 100 members of the Democratic caucus that have stood very fervently as anti-war supporters And then the other half that's more hawkish and a little bit more supportive of military action. So it isn't that there's no difference between the parties. There's quite a substantial difference. The reason why there appears to be no difference is because the number of people within the Democratic Party that sort of support the peace platform is not enough to overcome the supermajority requirements of the parties and the political system.
And of course, if we go back to the Vietnam War days, there are actually Republicans are opposed to the war as well.
Absolutely. And that was a time when the parties were less divided on these kinds of issues than they are today.
And now, what about the relation between in-the-streets activism and partisan politics? A lot of people think of that kind of movement activism as being apart from, to some degree, partisan or electoral politics, but you see a pretty tight linkage.
Well, there's definitely a difference between activism in the streets and activism in the electoral system. And a lot of people do only activism in the streets, and a lot of people do only activism in the electoral arena. But there are a substantial number of people that do both, and we call these people movement partisans in our research, and those are the people that we make up that make up what we call the party in the street. And during the peak of the anti-war movement, that group of people was a core important part of the movement. They were people that gave resources to the movement. They were the people that helped to build the connections in the movement. They were people that helped to systematically build the lobbying apparatus of the movement. So there was a time when the people who did both were really critical to the anti-war voice and the anti-war message. I think what we've seen in the last few years is that this group of people has lost interest in being involved in anti-war activism in particular.
Now, there were two groups who were sort of organizing competing demonstrations against the war back in the day. ANSWER, which was a project of the Workers' World Party, ultimately, and United for Peace and Justice. What can you say about those two coalitions and their relation to anti-war politics?
Okay, I would add to that there's really a third group which was very important, which is MoveOn.org. And MoveOn.org played an important role of mobilizing the democratically oriented activists into the movement. So you could sort of say that MoveOn.org was on the far right of the anti-war movement. The organization you mentioned, United for Peace and Justice, was very much in the center of the anti-war movement. Many Americans would think of its position sort of on the left of the American political system, but still somewhat centrist to anti-war activism. United for Peace and Justice was a broad coalition which was able to mobilize hundreds of thousands of people into street activism and also raise quite a substantial amount of money and coordinate networks among peace organizations across the country. And United for Peace and Justice was a very important representative of what we call these movement partisans, people that could see both the benefits of institutional activism and participating in the electoral system and being out involved in the streets. The final organization that you mentioned, the ANSWER Coalition, really is not as interested in engaging with the mainstream political system as either MoveOn.org or United for Peace and Justice. And ANSWER is very much on the far left of the anti-war movement and on the far left of the American political system, and they see the fundamental problem as capitalism, basically the imperialism of the U.S. government in foreign affairs. And so the ANSWER Coalition, while they were very important in mobilizing people to turn out in the streets and protest, they were not as important in getting people to participate more broadly in the political process through elections, through lobbying, and these kinds of mechanisms.
Now, doing the math in my head, the war in Afghanistan now has lasted about as long as the combined duration of World War I, World War II, and the Civil War. The war in Iraq is not that long, but it's approaching it. Is there any prospect for the revival of an anti-war movement, or has these just become a permanent part of our political landscape?
Many people who opposed the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war early on are still opposed to U.S. intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan and continue to oppose these wars. Public opinion against these wars still stands at the levels that it, a little bit below the levels that it was at during the Bush presidency. However, it seems unlikely that people will turn out in very large numbers to protest these wars. Largely the reason is that even though they may disagree with Barack Obama's policies in these areas, they don't see President Obama as a threat to peace in the same way that they saw President Bush as a threat to peace. And so absent this sense of threat, I think it's highly unlikely that we'll see large protests.
So the threat is really what really mobilizes people?
Threat is a key part of getting people to turn out into the streets and demonstrate. Threat is the difference between sitting in your living room and saying, that's really unfortunate, I disagree with that, and saying, this is something that we need to mobilize on, this is something that we need to do something about. And it's, ironically, it's Obama's non-threatening nature that has, in a sense, demobilized the anti-war movement.
Then similarly, the bombing of Libya, which might have excited protest if George Bush had done it, excited almost none at all. Similar reasons there?
Well, no, I would say that there's a fairly substantial difference between what's happening in Libya and what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. Libya is a small-scale action, militarily speaking, that doesn't involve a U.S. occupation. And so presidents actually use force, military force, quite regularly. And when presidents use force on a small scale, as President Obama has done in the case of Libya, it's rare that you see any kind of widespread opposition, no matter who the president is or what the political circumstances are. The president, as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces in the United States, just has the power to act quickly and unilaterally in a way that allows him to avoid any kind of substantial political opposition. In contrast, both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were major political operations that involved the U.S. occupation and governance of two different countries. So we're really talking about military operations that are on very different scales.
And then finally, this is rather speculative, but the Vietnam War was fought by draftees. The current wars are being fought by volunteers. How does that figure into the development of an anti-war movement?
Well, there's a huge difference between the 1960s and the 2000s in terms of the threat that was posed to people who were protesting. During the 1960s, of course, there was a draft in progress, and because of that draft, the prospect of a continued war was a major threat to people who were potentially interested in activism. And as a result, Vietnam anti-war protests were perceived by the political system as being much more disruptive to the political order. The more recent anti-war protests, because people have not been subject to the draft, has made the tone and the tenor of the protests a much more normal, routine part of the American political system. And so there wasn't that sense of potential disruption with this recent round of protests as there was during the Vietnam War era.
That was Michael Heaney, professor of political science at the University of Michigan, who, along with his colleague Fabio Rojas, has been studying the anti-war movement and its disappearance. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back to hear from Roger Lowenstein after this musical break. Continuing my personal 90s indie rock revival that was so smooth, some dyke core from a band called The Moves, three Smith alums from the end of the 90s. My next guest is Roger Lowenstein. His book, The End of Wall Street, is just out in paperback from Penguin. Roger Lowenstein. Let's start with some what were they thinking kinds of questions. I always wonder, what were they thinking when I look at many disasters? Well, let's go back and think, talk about the bubble days before we hit the wall. What were these Wall Street honchos thinking? Were any of them concerned about what was going on? Did any of them see a possibility of disaster in the future, or are they just so wrapped up in making as much money in as short a period of time that they didn't even think about consequences?
Doug, I think, unfortunately, a lot of them were wrapped up in making money in a short period of time. They were certainly wrapped up in imitating their peers who might have been making more money. In the case, for instance, of Merrill Lynch, Stan O'Neill was known to be just consumed with envy for Goldman Sachs and also for Lehman Brothers, which was a leader in mortgage finance. And O'Neill was pressing his troops at every juncture to get more involved in mortgages, buy a mortgage issuer, get more into the securitization and so on, and mortgages, and, you know, if it's good enough for Lehman, it's good enough for us. In fact, and there are memos of firms wanting to be but more like Lehman Brothers, as implausible as that may sound. You know, what was Lehman thinking? Lehman was thinking that, look, we're putting a lot of these securities on our books. We have, you know, a huge balance sheet weighed down with mortgage securities, but they would describe themselves as being in the moving business, not in the storage business, which meant that maybe a time would come when mortgage securities wouldn't be a good thing to own, but by then Lehman supposed that, you know, they would have long since gotten out of the trade. And I think in one way or another, all of Wall Street was thinking that. And, you know, that's really the greater fool theory. It's really what lies in the mix in almost every one of these bubbles. If you think about the Washington Mutual, the mortgage bank that issued so many of these bad mortgages, they said in their books that we're in the business of issuing loans and packaging into Wall Street. And they further said if a day ever comes when we're not able to package them, when the securitization channel breaks down, we could be in real trouble. And, you know, any child who's played musical chairs knows that when the music stops, there ain't a seat for everybody. But I think almost at every level, the Wall Street and the financial players assumed that they wouldn't be the ones holding the bag.
There are several tiers of all this. You had originators like Countrywide and even less reputable characters.
It was hard to get a lot less reputable than Countrywide.
Well, yeah, but there are also, I think, a bunch of real low-rent guys who are foisting second mortgages on poor black folks in Queens. So, I mean, that's what I had in mind as being worse even than Countrywide, but I get your point. They're originating mortgages at this retail level and then packaging them and passing them along to the people on Wall Street. Were the big-name Wall Street banks latecomers to this game, or were they there from the beginning?
Well, some of them, for a bank like Lehman, that could never aspire to be or could never become, say, a peer to Goldman Sachs in mergers and acquisitions or in corporate advice, mortgages were really tailor-made because, you know, unlike, say, with going public where there's certain prestige to saying my banker's Morgan Stanley, my banker's Goldman Sachs, nobody cared who packaged your mortgage. And so Lehman got in this game very early. You know, Bear Stearns got in it very early. I mean, the first people to get in the game were Fannie and Freddie. And what happened was that people like Lehman and Bear Stearns and others started literally competing with Fannie and Freddie. And that had the result that Fannie and Freddie began to say, you know, we're going to lose market share unless we start doing deals that are as bad as the ones that the private securitizers are doing. And that in fact, is what happened.
You mentioned Fannie and Freddie, and this is an important point. To partisan Republicans, they're pretty much the whole problem. To partisan Democrats, they're totally innocent. To a lot of partisan Republicans, it's all the Community Reinvestment Act. And if it hadn't been for that, then we would have had no financial crisis. Could you sort that all out for us, just how
sure.
culpable are
Let's
Fannie
Let's take
and
the first thing, the Community Reinvestment Act. That was really a non-entity. No one made banks, forced banks to write bad loans. No one said to them, don't ask to see your customer's identification, accept a stated loan, you know, known later as a liar's loan. No one said to them, issue 100% of the value in, you know, in mortgages and so on. That's really, you know, a theory propounded by some, I guess, right-wing Republicans to pin it all on the government. And I think that's somewhat dropped out. The Fannie and Freddie charge is more serious. And by the way, I don't know anyone who says they had nothing to do with it or they were a very big player in guaranteeing mortgages and helping to inflate the bubble. However, as I said before, Fannie and Freddie were forced to do a lower quality of deals because the private label competition, such as Bear Stearns, such as Lehman Brothers, Morgan Stanley, and others, were already doing bad deals. And their memos, and I report these in my book, where they say, we either have to meet the competition where the competition is, or we're going to lose market share. And so, I mean, that's the proof that the private market, and Countrywide too, was also in the business of securitizing loans. The private market was doing these highly speculative, highly risky deals before Fannie and Freddie, and really lured them in. Now, the terrible damage was that there was a certain limit to how much capital Countrywide could raise, and therefore how many deals they could do. Once Fannie and Freddie decided to do risky deals, undercapitalized mortgages and so on, there was virtually no limit to the amount of the volume of bad deals they could do, because since they had this government imprimatur, they could borrow as much as they wanted. So the combination of having entities that were for profit and suffered for, you know, felt the profit motive, but also had the government's backing, you know, was especially insidious. They weren't the whole problem, but they were certainly a good part of the problem.
Was there anybody in the government who was supposed to be scrutinizing them or regulating them, or are they just pretty much on their own?
Yeah, there was a government regulator. It was pretty toothless, and there were hearings about this. And to their credit, John Snow, the former Treasury Secretary, and Alan Greenspan really did sound the alarm bells on Fannie and Freddie, and much as he now seeks to ignore or refute that fact or hide that fact, you know, Barney Frank was their very, very vocal supporter and champion. He said what they're doing is safe, and then there was a hearing when someone said we're going to have to bail them out, and he said, well, we just won't. We'll let them fail. I mean, this is on record. It's in the book. Now, it's not a coincidence that Greenspan was prescient on Fannie and Freddie and not on other things, because he was open to the idea that government involvement might be poisonous. He was much less open to the idea that anything in the private sector could be going awry, and he totally missed those signals.
Now, Congress really covered for Fannie and Freddie, and was it campaign contributions? Was it some sort of populism, some desire to promote mortgage finance to help?
Yeah, it was the American dream, and it wasn't just Democrats. Bush, Fannie and Freddie had a quota that what part of their deals had to go to so-called affordable housing, basically housing for people who couldn't afford it otherwise, non-market housing. And it was politically very popular. And those quotas kept going up under Bush as well as under Clinton. I mean, who could be against affordable housing? And to the Congress, it was just an incredible sort of free lunch, because all Freddie and Fannie were doing was issuing a guarantee. And unless they went broke, well, that wouldn't cost the taxpayers anything. So all these people could get cheaper mortgages because of the Freddie and Fannie guarantee. Well, since then, we found out that the guarantee did cost something. I mean, that has been by far the most expensive of the bailouts, the bailout of Fannie and Freddie. You know, the banks are, as we've seen, the private banks are paying back their TARP loans. But Fannie and Freddie, will never come close. The government will be on the hook for, it's already more than $150 billion. Anyway, it was just... For Congress, it was a free lunch, and it was perceived as a free lunch for various administrations as well.
And also in the what were they thinking department? What about the regulators? Were people in the Fed paying attention to the bubble as it was growing? Were people in the FDIC or the Treasury, or did they just sort of take the same narcotic that everyone else did?
One problem with mortgage regulation, and the one problem with mortgage regulation is it barely existed, or it existed in such fractured form. There were state-chartered banks regulated at a state level, and generally there were, abysmal sort of regulation, not nearly enough staffing and so on. There were federally chartered banks. The federally chartered banks were divided up, the regulation of between the Fed, the Treasury, the FDIC, thrift organization. That is to say, some of the federal banks were considered commercial banks, some were considered thrifts. So there were all these different bodies with an oar in. In 2004, John Dugan, who was the comptroller of the currency, really was the first to see and to be warned that all kinds of daffy loans were being written. And he brought this to the attention of various other federal regulators, including the Fed. And that was really when Alan Greenspan, I think, really fell down on the job because he just wasn't willing to listen. And I think the reason was that his mindset was so much one of believing in the efficacy of the private market. It just wasn't part of Greenspan's worldview to accept that private bankers would be doing things that would bring their own institutions into risk, although, you know, of course they were. And by the way, I should say that, there were a great many other mortgages that weren't regulated at all because they were issued by non-bank banks, which, although they were issuing mortgages, weren't taking deposits and therefore weren't considered banks. So the mortgage regulation was both unfocused and balkanized and suffered from this, on the part of the Fed, real free market bias.
I'm speaking with Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street. A Hungarian economist said after the as the Soviet-style systems were falling apart that they were systems of generalized irresponsibility. It seemed like this characterizes the era of the Wall Street during the bubble days. How much did the securitization contribute to the indifference to credit quality?
Well, I think it really did, because I think the further you get from an asset, the harder it is to make the intelligent bottom-up, you know, based on the fundamentals judgment that we want bankers and creditors to make. You know, is the customer behind on their payments? Do they have enough income to make their payments? Are they paying, you know, a reasonable? Are they financing a reasonable amount given the value of the property? You know, one banker can make this judgment about his customers. But, you know, when you get 1,000 of these loans packaged into a bond, and then you get, you know, many of these bonds packaged into a CDO, and then that CDO is packaged with, you know, other CDOs into a CDO squared, some investor at the end of that chain obviously has no clue. You know, they're not going to go house to house in Irvine, California or someplace. All they can do, and this was supposedly the fail-safe in the securitization process, all they can do is rely on a credit rating. And the credit rating companies really weren't doing anything but feeding backward evidence of past default rates into a computer and spitting out the conclusion that the future would be okay.
Let's now talk about, a bit about the crisis. Things started looking a little wobbly, I guess, in 2006, and then in 2007, the wheels started coming off. How long did it take people to realize that this was just no little bump in the road, but something really, really serious?
Well, it took most people, and it took the regulators quite a while. Now, you know, there are people in the book, you know, I open the book with an anecdote about an investor who has a bad dream and wakes up and sells all his Fannie and Freddie, and that's in February 2006, 2.5 years before they were seized and you know, the crisis really hit. So, and there are others, and obviously we know that Goldman Sachs got out and was short mortgage securities, and J.P. Morgan lightened up considerably, you know, by, I'd say, the end of 2006, early 2007. But most investors didn't, and Ben Bernanke, you know, said till very, very late in the game, this is just a subprime issue, and then it was just a mortgage issue, and he continued to say it wouldn't have any effect or wouldn't have any significant effect.
Did he really believe that, or was that just for reassurance?
No, I think he really believed it. I don't think Bernanke would deliberately mislead. I understand that the Fed's words are weighed heavily, and so he has a responsibility not to to start a snowball panic in the other direction. But I think he really believed that. Bernanke is very much a top-down sort of analyst, a models guy. I think he's someone who looked at past experience. The U.S. had never had, at least since the Depression, a financial mortgage breakdown like this. You know, what he didn't do was what various investors did, was to say, hey, wait a second, these subprime mortgages are bundled in the CDOs. These CDOs are owned by Merrill Lynch and by Citigroup. You know, what's going to hold up these companies if subprime goes? I don't think he was not trained as that type of a bottom-up, case-by-case analyst, and I think...
But he had hundreds of economists and analysts of all sorts working for him at the Fed. Was anybody thinking about this?
When you get 100 economists, as the Fed has, you get conventional wisdom. To make a really contrarian call such as, gee, every mortgage bank in the country has been loosening its standards by an amazing degree in mortgages for years. Prices have risen as they never had before. If prices should start to fall, every one of those banks is going to be in trouble. You're more likely to get two economists agreeing on that than 100. You know, when you get 100, you get conventional wisdom. There's a scene in the book where I think it's Fitch holds a meeting for investors, and they're making the prediction that everything's going to be fine. Although this is in the period where everybody's recognizing that we're in some bumpy period for real estate, but nonetheless, Fitch is saying there's nothing really to worry about in mortgage securities. And an investor asks them, well, what would happen? And Fitch is using the hypothesis that real estate prices will appreciate at a lower rate but continue to appreciate. And this investor asks Fitch, well, what will happen? What would happen if real estate was flat, if prices stopped appreciating? And Fitch said, well, then the model, that is to say the model by which they had rated securities, would start to break down. And then the investor said, well, what would happen if real estate prices actually fell by a couple of percent, say for a couple of years in a row? And Fitch said, well, then the model would break down completely. That's kind of astonishing to base the models of the sector of the economy that is, you know, most prolific and most important on the notion that prices won't fall by as much as a couple of percent for a couple of years after an unprecedented rise in prices. And it does show you the extent to which, you know, the Kool-Aid was circulating.
Bad groupthink operates in both the public and the private sector.
Exactly.
Now, as the crisis was unfolding, were there off-the-shelf plans, or were they just improvising as they went along?
There were off-the-shelf plans. You know, they were revising those plans. But, you know, you never know. Look, Ben Bernanke had based his life's work on a study of the Great Depression. Did that make him any better prepared when September 08 hit? You know, maybe a little, but because the particulars of every crisis are different than what you might have prepared for, what you might have studied. So everyone wants to know, for instance, this is a very important point, why did Paulson and Bernanke and so on bail out AIG and not Lehman? And this wasn't in any document that they'd written up, you know, 6 months earlier. You know, we'll let Lehman go, but not AIG. These folks did not want to do bailouts. They were good rib-rock Republicans. They didn't come into office, you know, hoping to bail out banks, nor did the Democrats, for that matter. And so when Lehman came, they said, all right, we're going to stick them with some of this good moral hazard medicine, you know, and let them taste the consequences. Within 36 hours, not only was AIG about to go under, but it looked like every other investment bank was going to go under, and it looked like the entire money market system, perhaps even more seriously, was going to suffer a panic. So this was so unprecedented and so unanticipated that whatever the plans they had been drawing up, you know, whatever the, you know, plans in the red envelopes or whatever, they just could have went by the wayside.
And finally, I think people will look at your title, The End of Wall Street, and actually some might think that was overly optimistic. From this point of view, and you do address this in your afterword, but from this point of view, it looks remarkably like not all that much has changed. They're doing an awful lot of the same stuff. There has not been systemic reform of a really profound nature like we saw in the 1930s. The pay packages are still enormous, and Wall Street is pretty much free to do what it wants. They're more concentrated than ever, bigger than ever. And now they feel like, well, you know, if the moral hazard problem has been raised several powers, it seems. So, really, what has changed?
The moral hazard problem hasn't change, although I have to say I don't think that was a big contributor. I don't think most of the creditors, let's say, to Lehman Brothers were lending the money because they thought that Lehman would be bailed out. In fact, it wasn't bailed out. I think the creditors in the main were just as much deluded as the investors were and figured that Lehman wasn't going to fail. The title refers to the end of Wall Street, you know, as we knew it. It's not a suggestion nor a hope that Wall Street stopped because we need Wall Street, as we found out, you know, when it failed. I think, to me, it's the end of the era, the end of the era when Wall Street thought and society thought and the government thought that it could regulate itself. It was the high point of this idea of laissez-faire. Alan Greenspan said, you know, a derivative contract negotiated by private banks doesn't need regulation. Because, you know, they'll regulate themselves. That Wall Street, that all-powerful self-directed Wall Street, you know, I think hit its apogee then. The Dodd-Frank bill, I mean, to answer your question more specifically, does some important things, and the regulations on bank capital do some very important things. What's unfortunate about both are that it's going to be up to the regulators to enforce these changes. I mean, and this bill is 2,000 pages, right? So it really gets in the trenches. And when banks start going back to the regulators, particularly as good times improve, and say, can't you loosen up on the derivatives restrictions a little bit? Can't you loosen up and let us issue more loans? Do we really have to comply with this interpretation of the capital rules? It's going to be very hard for the regulators to say no. It always is. And, you know, you mentioned the 30s. In the 30s, there was a kind of a very easy fix, which was just to say, let's have some disclosure. There really hadn't been any disclosure. If you issue a security, you know, you have to comply with the new requirements of the Securities Act. That was the profound change in the 30s. You can't take the investor's money without disclosing to the investor what has now become standard requirements. These are more complicated issues. I mean, there were some clean strokes. You can't be a proprietary trader now, for instance, if you're a federally chartered bank, and you know, Goldman Sachs isn't anymore. Derivatives have to go through a public clearing mechanism, although banks are fighting to what extent there are exceptions to that rule. And that's my great fear, is that in time, as memories of this crisis fade, there are going to be more and more exemptions to these new rules.
That was Roger Lowenstein, the veteran financial journalist whose book The End of Wall Street is just out in paperback from Penguin. I gotta say, his view of what's changed is much stronger than mine. I'm impressed by how little has changed about Wall Street, despite the massive crisis. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with one more bit of 90s dyke core, this from Third Sex, Mall 10997, MAUL, not shopping center. Till next week, bye.